Good morning.
Good morning.
I want to make an announcement. I didn't hear Rod make it this way, so maybe he just didn't have it in his notes or whatever, but we want to congratulate Johnny and Christy Bowers. They became the parents of a new daughter yesterday or last night, so need to remember them for that and congratulate them for that. I think the proud grandparents are Eddie and Edie. What a wonderful day that was. And then I got a note from Judd just before he got on the plane. One of the last things that he did was check his mail, and boy, was he surprised. He sent me a text message that says, "Thank you to everybody." It made him tear up. So there you go. We show our love to him. He shows his love to us all the time. How great is it to be part of a family? And that's what we're going to talk about today, is a family, the everlasting kingdom. And it starts off with a question. What is the church? And that's where we start with this idea. Daniel gives this prophecy in Daniel chapter 2 about the coming kingdom of God. It's actually revealed to a Babylonian king who is an evil man. Nebuchadnezzar was by no man's ideal a good person. He did some pretty horrible things in life. He did some things that in fact caused great consternation, and he conquered the Israelites. He kept them in captivity. He used them as slaves. He abused them in so many ways. He conquered other nations and abused them as well. He was not by any means a good person. We talked about that last week. There is evil in the world. We talked also about how God sometimes uses evil to create good or to cause good. And you know what happens here? What happens here is that God used an evil king to bring a prophecy about the coming kingdom that was going to be a good kingdom. That's what happens. And so Nebuchadnezzar has this dream, and in the verses we read, it talked about the dream itself. And then Daniel goes on and says, here's the meaning of the dream. And he tells him about the dream. The great head is you, O king. And he talks about that the next kingdom that will come up is the Medes and the Persians. And the next kingdom that will come up are the Greeks. And the final kingdom that will come up, that's made partly of iron and partly of clay, is the kingdom of the Romans. And in verse 44 he says, and in the days of those kings, O king, the Lord of heaven is going to raise up a kingdom which shall never be defeated. And so we're looking forward to that, and Daniel gives that prophecy there, and history will show us that the church is going to morph out of that. But what we see is this kingdom that begins, this church that begins as the pure church that Jesus established, starts changing. It starts morphing into various different things, and if we look at history, we see where the church went from being this church to being kind of a different church to being a whole bunch of different churches. So you go around the house or around the country today, and it's pretty evident there are lots and lots and lots and lots of churches that don't agree about a whole lot of things. All kinds of differences and all kinds of variances, and it doesn't look at all necessarily like the original church. But you see, that wasn't a surprise. Paul called the elders from Ephesus to him, and as he spoke to the elders from the church at Ephesus in Acts chapter 20, he said to them, I know that after my departure, fierce wolves will come in among you, not sparing the flock. And from among your own selves will arise men speaking twisted things to draw away disciples after them. It doesn't necessarily mean that every change that's ever happened was intended to draw people away from God. It doesn't mean that every change that's ever happened was brought in by wolves that were trying to destroy the church. What it means is you need to be careful, and that's actually what Paul had told the elders. Take heed for the flock of God over which God has made you overseers, or the Spirit has made you overseers. He's telling them to take heed, to be careful, to look and to watch, because there's only the church. Christ said, upon this rock I will build my church, not my churches. And yet, today it's so different. Today it's so different. Through the work of various reformers through the years, the church migrated back into a closer idea of what the New Testament shows. There was Luther, that's John Knox there, and it's Alexander Campbell up in the corner, and Barton Stone in the bottom, and some of these other innovators that we see in the church through the years that have tried to bring the church back to back to what it was in the New Testament. And the question is, have we arrived at back to what it was in the New Testament, or are we still trying to get the church back to where it's supposed to be? Are we, in fact, the church, or are we something different? And that's an important question. You say, well, maybe it's not that important, except here's the problem. Jesus said he would build his church. Now, do you want to be part of his church or something else? That's an important question. That's a very important question. That's why we're going to talk about it a little bit. Because today, whether or not you know it, today is the day of Pentecost. Not the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2, the day of Pentecost in 2022. Today's the day of Pentecost. And so today it's all appropriate to talk about what is the church. And maybe we ought to think about that a little bit as we celebrate the birthday of the church. We know that the church came into being on the day of Pentecost. We know that there were about 120 disciples there. And we know about the first fruits of the gospel being preached. About 3,000 were added to their number that day, and how wonderful that thing. But one of the things we read about the church, no matter where we go to read about it, was there were not many churches, there was one church. It was in many different locations, but it was only one church. And it's something we need to understand. In one of the major cities, such as Rome or maybe Ephesus, there may have been several home churches. But when Paul wrote to the church at Rome, he wrote to the church at Rome, the church at Ephesus. Later on, as he's saying goodbye at the end of his letter, you'll notice he'll say, greet so-and-so in the church that meets in their house, and so-and-so in the church that meets in their house. There are several congregations of believers, but there's only one church. Throughout the world, as we read through the New Testament, we see that Paul writes to the church at Rome, he writes to the church at Ephesus, he writes to the churches in Galatia, he writes to the churches wherever the churches may be, in Thessalonica or Colossae or wherever they happen to be, but he only writes to one church. Only one church. There are many congregations. They're spread throughout the world. As the church begins to grow, it grows and grows and grows. But there's a wonderful thing about the church. It's the wonderful thing about the church. One of the things I love best about it is whether I'm in Morrilton, Arkansas, or whether I'm in Branson, Missouri, or whether I'm in Florence, Kentucky, or whether I'm in Florence, Italy. When I show up at the church, I'm at the one church. The one church. I'm a member there, just like I am a member here. And how great that is to have family throughout the world. How great it is, as Judd points out sometimes, that throughout the world, on this particular day of the week, there are millions of people that are sitting like we are, and they're studying God's word like we are, and they're singing praises to God like we are, and they too are partaking of the emblems that remind them of the sacrifice that Jesus made for us. And how great that is to be a part of such a body. So it brings up a question for us. What is the church? You know, to some folks, it's just a location. Specifically, it's a place to worship. And even though Jesus, when he was having a discussion with the Samaritan woman, says, the time will come when neither at this place nor in Jerusalem will you worship God, because God wants people to worship him in spirit and in truth. It's not about the place, but some think that still. Some say it's an organization. Still others say that an organization is not really a living thing, but a church is a living thing. So the church is not an organization, it's an organism. And for a while in the late 80s, that was a big movement in the church to make sure we understood it was an organism, not an organization. And still others think of it as a charity. And it sits right beside the other charities in history, the Ford Foundation or the Winrock Foundation or whatever. It's just a charitable organization. And that's our job, is to feed the poor and to clothe those that are naked and things like that. And so we think of that maybe. Some think that the church is first and foremost an evangelistic organization or evangelistic platform. Their favorite words are, the fruit of a Christian is another Christian. As if our primary purpose was just to grow and grow and grow and grow and grow instead of following God. Maybe it's the social setting. You know, that way people can meet and enjoy company of each other. They have similar values and interests. And it is that, but it's much more than that. Some think it's an alternative for young people, kind of like a prom alternative. It gives them some place to go rather than being out on the streets. And so maybe that's why the church exists. And some think of the church as a way to bring about change. The church is a forum for change. We can bring in our political ideas, and we can bring in all of our philosophical ideas, and then we can go out together and we can change the world based upon whatever our political or philosophical ideals are. I've seen that happen quite a bit. Or maybe the church is there to assuage guilt. Well, I don't have to feel guilty about my sins because I went to church. And so maybe it's there just to assuage guilt because we feel like we ought to be there. Or maybe it's a way to eliminate or reduce the fear of hell. I don't want to go to hell, so I'll go to church. I've heard the preacher, it's not a whole lot different. No, I'm kidding. But sometimes that's the way it seems, the way we view church. For some people, it's a way to combat loneliness. I'm so lonely all the time. I'll just go join myself to this group of people, and at least I won't be lonely. And we see that quite a bit. To some, the church is a power base. I've known people, you have too, who were involved in sales or in some other high-level business that dealt with the public quite a bit, who would join a church simply because that church had more people in it and they could contact more people to get more votes, or contact more people to make more sales, or contact more people to advance themselves in one way or another. And we see that sometimes. And still others see the church as a place to get away from sinners. Good luck on that. As far as I know, we're all sinners. You know, but some people see that. In the last 11 years or so, I've noticed that we, as a congregation, have our own ideas about what the church is. Some, or what we would want it to be, some want to see us as a vibrant, growing church that's making an impact in the community and in the world. I would agree with that. I've heard people say they'd like to see the parking lot full and the classrooms full of little children going to Bible class, and I would agree with that as well. And I've heard people say, I wish we had lots of families of all ages. And I look out and I kind of see that, but I would agree with that as well. Lots of hugging going on. I like that. Jennifer's not here today, but Jennifer during COVID said the thing she missed more than anything else was hugs. So when you see her back next week, give her a hug and tell her, hey, I know you miss these. Someone says, I want pews so full that finding a good seat's a challenge. And that is still a challenge. It's a challenge now. There's lots of good seats at the front. You just can't see them because we all fight for the good seats at the back. But that's okay. Somebody says, well, I'd like to see baptisms, like maybe 3 or 4 a month, and that would make me happy, and that's what I think the church ought to look like. And someone else says this idea of the whole community falling in love with Jesus as they see the love we have for each other. That might have been my idea. Someone says, I want to be known as a church that praises God and has fun and lives so that people can see Jesus living in us. That's a pretty good idea. I've heard people say that they want to see the church as a body that supports mission works and is involved in Bible study with others that are outside the church. And I think that's a good idea. And some say, I'd like to see a place where the individual members are involved in Bible study and they're daily and they're involved in prayer and you can see it in their lives. Or maybe arming our children with Bible knowledge so that they're ready to go out and face the challenges of the world. You know, a haven for members in our community and a help for those in our community that are hurting. Well, those are all ideals that I see as I talk to us as members of this particular congregation as the things we look for and want our church to be. And in many ways, we are those things. In some ways, we probably got a little bit of work to do. And we could do better. And I'd challenge us to do better. But I think they seem to be consistent with the ideals and the goals that Jesus had for his church. But here's the question. Do they at all define the church Jesus said he was going to build? Do they define the church Jesus said he was going to build? You know, since we're heirs to several attempts at partial or complete reformation of the church, Maybe every now and then we ought to ask ourselves, are we the church we're trying to be? Are we truly the church of Christ? The one he said he would build. The one that he promised would come. The eternal kingdom, everlasting kingdom of him. There have been lots of attempts to get there. But are we there? Let's see what Jesus' vision is. You know, sometimes we look at the blueprint and we get an idea of how to build something. But if we get away from the blueprint, we can build things that don't look anything at all like what they were intended to be. Anybody ever try to put together a baby crib? Even with the plans, it's almost impossible. But if you try to ignore the plans, something's going to snap into place perfectly, and it's going to be impossible to build it because you can't build it with that piece there before the other piece gets there. But now it's snapped into place permanently. And so you end up with a baby crib that looks more like the Titanic or a submarine or something like that. I don't know. Boy, it's so hard sometimes because we ignore the plans. And when we do that, maybe the best way is to see what Jesus says when he says he's going to build his church. It starts with a statement. In Matthew chapter 16, he, Jesus, said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter replied, "You're the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah." That literally means the son of John. Simon, the son of John. "For flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who's in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." If you're reading from the King James Version, it says Hades instead of hell there in that particular phrase. He goes on, "I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." And so there are some things Jesus said about the church. And he said specifically four things. He said the church is built on a rock. He says the church is made up of those he's called out, his ecclesia. That the gates of Hades will not prevail against his church. And that he would give someone called you the keys to the kingdom of heaven. And in this particular case, it looks pretty clear. This "you" probably refers back to Peter, but we'll look at those. We're going to look at those four things individually as we begin. It's built on a rock. The church is built on a rock, not that particular rock. But the church is built on a rock. And if we're in the church, we're built on the rock. What is the rock? We can be very certain from scriptures that we know what the rock is. "For who is God but the Lord? And who is a rock except our God?" That's 2 Samuel 22, verse 32. And by the way, it's also Psalms 18 and 31. If God said it twice, don't you think he wanted us to hear it? I can remember when the kids were growing up, if I said something twice, they better have heard it. I counted, I don't know how many times, I said 1, 2. When Christy was married, she asked me, "Daddy, what would have ever happened if you got to 3? I said, "I don't know, I never had to get there." What a blessing that is, even in and of itself. But here we go, we understand there's only one rock. It's our God. The rock wasn't a person, place, or thing. You know, it wasn't Peter, it wasn't Caesarea Philippi where they were at, or it wasn't some kind of religious relic or ceremony. The rock wasn't a person, place, or thing. It was rather Peter's faith in who Jesus was. You know how I know? Because Peter says later on that the church wasn't built on him. He saw a truth that no one before him had seen. That's what happened. What he saw was that Jesus was the Christ, the Son of God. No one had ever confessed that before because no one else had noticed it before. It wasn't that Peter was a rocket scientist. No, he was a fisherman. And yet he saw something that others didn't see. And he writes so that we can understand that Jesus is the cornerstone on which the church is built. Jesus is the cornerstone, not you and not me and not Peter. And so we understand that as we look at it. And he says himself that it's not built on him, it's built on Jesus. The church is Jesus's ecclesia, literally those who are called out, the assembly or called out ones, the special ones. And as we look at that word and we see that word, we see it in other places. And the Greek word itself actually carries a connotation of any assembly. It doesn't necessarily mean the church, but in religious connotations, it means a church or a religious gathering. And so it refers to a religious gathering, but it could also be your family ecclesia that you have every year in June when all the people come together that don't like each other very much and pretend to be family for about 30 minutes, as long as there's a meal. It could be that. I mean, that's what the word means, but here in this case, Jesus is talking about those who are called out, his particular people who are called together and called out. Peter goes on from his previous passage to explain who they are. But you, he's writing to the church, to the Christians of the dispersion, he's writing to the church, you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Oh, okay. We were called out. We were called out of darkness and into light. That's what Peter says of us, the church. And then we find out that the third thing Jesus says, the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. You ever see a gates of a fortified city go out and attack somebody? What are the gates for in a fortified city? They're not to go and attack. They're to keep people out. They're just defensive. That's all they're for. And I've heard all kinds of things that means that the church can go out in the world and Satan can't prevail against us. And there's some truth to that. But there's another side of that as we look at it and understand it, that Jesus said that the gates of the grave, the gates of Hades, will not prevail against his church. And maybe we hadn't looked at that as much to understand that, because what he's actually saying is that the gates of Hades will not prevail as a barrier to keep anyone from escaping the grave. Up until Adam, or ever since Adam, I guess, no one's escaped from the grave. The grave has claimed everyone. No one has escaped from the grave. But Jesus did. Jesus did that. Satan's stronghold is death, because that's his ultimate objective, and there's no escape except by a key. And Jesus holds the key. Satan was defeated. And no longer can he hold prisoners in the realm of death. That's an important thing. You know, Revelation, Jesus says of himself, I died, and behold, I'm alive forevermore, and I have the keys of death and Hades. Isn't that great that Jesus has the keys for that? And then Paul writes to the church in Corinth, something important about Jesus. He says, behold, I tell you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet. For the trumpet will sound, and the dead will be raised imperishable, and we shall be changed. For this perishable body must put on the imperishable. This mortal body must put on immortality. When the perishable puts on the imperishable, and the mortal puts on immortality, then shall come to pass the saying that is written. Look at this. Death is swallowed up in victory. The gates of death, the gates of Hades, cannot prevail against the Christian, because we will rise again. And there's a message there that we ought to hear. There's a message there that we need to see. You know, Jesus conquered death in the grave. The gates of Hades didn't prevail against Jesus. The grave couldn't hold him, and the grave cannot hold his called out either. And I think we need to teach that. I think we need to preach that. I think we need to share that. I think we ought to feel good about that. I think we ought to have confidence in the promise that we're not like Rover. When we die, we're not dead all over. We're just beginning our walk. How wonderful that is. What a great promise that is, and we ought to understand it. And then he gives a fourth lesson in this particular passage in Matthew. I will give you, or to you, the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Now, there's an interesting thing right there. Jesus said he's going to give the keys to who? To you. Does that mean Peter? Does that mean all the apostles? Does that mean everybody who's ever going to be a Christian is going to have the keys to the kingdom of heaven? You know, it seems very clear that he's still talking to Peter here about these keys. And And I think maybe we need to understand, because Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this world. So Peter's given keys, and to a kingdom, the kingdom of heaven, which Jesus says to Pontius Pilate is not the kingdom of the world. It's a heavenly kingdom there. And it's the very one that Daniel 2 and 44 has foretold. That's why our scripture reading was as it was. And as Daniel explained it, he said, in the days of those kings, the Lord of heavens will establish a kingdom which shall never pass away. Okay, so we're talking about a pretty important kingdom. Peter's got the keys, and the question is, well, why don't we look at them in just a minute? The church is the present manifestation of that kingdom that we see, because Jesus said his kingdom was going to be like that. And then he tells about his kingdom before he goes. Now, he's promised the keys. Peter's holding the keys. Don't forget, Peter's holding the keys. And then Jesus goes and decides to tell in parables about the kingdom. And why did he talk in parables? Maybe because the disciples said to him, why do you speak in parables? And he answered them, to you it's been given to know the secrets of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it's not been given. So what did he say about the kingdom and the parables? Well, in Matthew 15, we see quite a bit about them. Actually, that's supposed to be Matthew 13. Is it a 3? It is. Matthew 13. We see quite a bit about the parables. The kingdom of heaven is like a grain of mustard seed. It's like leaven. It's like a treasure hidden in a field. It's like a merchant in search of fine pearls. The kingdom of heaven is like a net that's thrown into the sea. The kingdom of heaven is like a master of a house who brings out of his treasure what's new and what's old. All of these parables Jesus tells in Matthew 13 to tell us about his church. But he doesn't quit there. In Matthew 18, he continues speaking of his church. He says, unless you turn aside, or unless you turn and become like children, you'll never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like a child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And that's not all he did when he was talking to him in parables. He says in Matthew 20, a master of a house who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. You remember that parable? In Matthew 25, 10 virgins who took their lamps, and some of them took extra oil and some of them didn't take extra oil as they waited for the bridegroom. In Luke 13, it's like leaven that a woman put into a loaf, and she leavened the whole loaf for 3 measures of flour till it's all leavened. And we look at that and we get back to the idea of, so what are these keys? What keys is he talking about? The keys to the kingdom of heaven that Peter's been holding over here all this time were to be used twice. They're to unlock the kingdom of heaven. In Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost, Peter unlocked the kingdom of heaven to the Jews who were present by preaching the gospel of Christ. And it unlocked the kingdom of heaven. And that day many were added to the kingdom. Many were added to the church. They're used a second time in Acts chapter 10 when Peter appears to speak to Cornelius, a devout man of a regiment of Roman soldiers. And when Peter speaks to him and he teaches him the gospel of Jesus Christ, he unlocks the kingdom of heaven for the Gentiles as well. And men came in. And through the years, many, many have come in. How wonderful that is. It's about 8 years after the day of Pentecost when that happens. So here's a question. By giving Peter the keys to the kingdom of heaven, did Jesus mean he was giving Peter the power to absolve sins or to pass his power down to somebody else or to pass that power down to somebody else? And the answer is no, he didn't do any of those things. And in fact, quite differently, Peter verified that himself. When he said Jesus was the cornerstone, not Peter is the cornerstone of the church. The church was not built on Peter, the church was built on Jesus. Peter's very clear about that in 2 Peter chapter 2. Nor was Jesus saying that Peter's going to stand at the pearly gates and he's going to see whether you've got good deeds or bad deeds and determine where you go. That's a cartoon. That's not what the Bible says. Nor is Peter, who's going to be a great leader in the fledgling church. This is important. Peter's going to be a very dominating force in the early church. And Jesus is making sure that neither Peter, who's going to be this dominating force, nor anybody else can change anything about his church. And that's important, because that's where we started off. When we look at the church through the years, when we look at the church through the ages, when we look at the history of the church and the history of the world and the way things have gone, so many changes have happened. Jesus said that first day that neither Peter nor anyone else can make any changes to the church. Literally, what Jesus said there was, whatever you bind on earth shall be the things that are already bound in heaven. And whatever you loose shall be the things that are already loosed in heaven. In other words, don't add to or take away from the word of God. That's what Jesus is telling his early church leaders. Don't change God's plan. Don't change my plan for my church. And he's trying to make that very clear. And through the years, we have twisted that in every possible way you can. Well, I like this, so we'll add it. I don't like that, we'll take it out. And you can add in whatever you want to in those little blanks there and whatever it is that we've done. Earlier today, we talked about the idea that there were 3,000 baptized on the day of Pentecost. And they were the first fruits of the gospel. But they were just the beginning. I mean, they're going to be followed by many more throughout history, including, hopefully, us. That's who we're trying to be. We who are born again are part of the firstborn, and how wonderful that is to have our names written in heaven. Aren't you glad of that? There are many other biblical descriptions and metaphors for the church. I'm not going to read them all. You can see them up there. The church and the way and the body and the assembly. And I mean, you can go through all of these different things and see the different metaphors and descriptions of the church as we look there. That's what the church is. That's who the church is. Because if you are a Christian, you are the church, just as surely as my hand is me. Do you know they can identify me by one fingerprint out of 10? Oh, wait. That's so outdated. They can identify me by one swab of saliva. And they can identify me exactly. That one swab of saliva is me. Just like I am the church, and just like you are the church, and just like we, when we come together, are the church. And so we need to understand that as we look at it. If we get the biblical descriptions right, we will never lose sight of the church Jesus built. The church is nothing more or less than the Christians. So how about a few general observations of the church, and then we're going to close. A church is no greater or no less, depending on its size. I've heard people say, you know, well, it's the great big church, you're bound to be a better church. Well, in the early church, many of the churches met in homes. We call those house churches today. Many of them met in homes, and we see where they met day to day in homes, and then they met at the temple too. So many times they met in a big public auditorium so that they could meet together as a large group. So whether they're a large group or whether they're a small group, they're still the church. And we need to understand that. There's a movement in the church today that we need to quit having big churches in buildings. We need to just go to having small churches in homes. That's not the way they did it in the New Testament. That's one of the things they did in the New Testament. But that's not all they did. They also met in the large group because they needed the support of one another. Other thing we see is that Jesus built just one church, but its local manifestations are spoken of as being churches. That is not more than one church. That's one church in various locations. And we need to understand that. Some people think, well, you know, you do church your way, and we'll do church our way, and I'll go to the church of my choice, and you go to the church of your choice, and we're all going the same place in the same direction anyway. But Jesus didn't say, I'm going to build the church of your choice. Did he? Well, that's not at all what he said. I'm going to build my church. Not my churches. My church. The church. I have people get offended sometimes when I say I'm a member of the church. They'll say, well, what denomination are you? And I say, well, I'm a member of the Church of Christ. And they'll say, well, you act like you think you're the only church. I'm trying to be a member of the Church of Christ. Not a denomination, not a name on a wall, but literally a body of believers that's trying to follow the teachers of our cornerstone upon which it's built. That's what I'm trying to be, and that's who I'm trying to be.